Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Unmasking Autism with AFO. I am your host, Carly Marissa Dummett. This podcast is presented by the Autism Foundation of Oklahoma and funded by the Oklahoma State Department of Health. For those who don't know, the Autism Foundation of Oklahoma strives to improve the lives of Oklahomans with autism across the lifespan. Before we jump in, I would just like to say that this podcast will discuss autism, suicide, mental health and wellness, among other topics, with autistic individuals and different professionals, with the goal of unmasking stereotypes, increasing awareness, advocating for mental health and wellness, and attempting to shatter the stigmas of these topics through conversation and personal experience. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Unmasking Autism with AFO. I have another guest who's been on our podcast before today, my dear friend, Ashley Bartlett. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. You want to tell everybody a little bit about you?
So, as you said, my name is Ashley. I'm 38 years old. I was a late-in-life diagnosis with autism, but a little bit something that I do in my day-to-day. I'm an advocate at a homeless shelter, and I really enjoy that. And I also perform stand-up in my free time, and that's how you and I met each other.
Yeah.
As far as the topics of what we're going to be on today with autism, I was diagnosed when I was 38, and up until then had honestly just what seemed like a myriad of misdiagnoses: bipolar 1, bipolar 2, borderline personality disorder, OCD, different types of anxiety disorders, different types of depression. And nothing helped. Like, all the therapies that I went through, the medications, I've been in inpatient, outpatient programs. So just struggled a lot with that, experienced a lot of trauma because of it. And honestly, comedy is something that helps with that. So.
Yeah. And we are going to circle back around to comedy, because I think comedy is a way you and I both practice wellness for ourselves. So let's start with talking about the late in life diagnosis. You know, as you just said, you know, you've been misdiagnosed with things before you were diagnosed with autism. So how did your autism diagnosis come about?
So when I was 34, I didn't realize it was an autistic burnout, since I didn't know I had autism yet. It was like I considered my fourth nervous breakdown of my adult life. And so I went into a partial hospitalization program at a psychiatric facility. And that means that you're basically there full time Monday through Friday, and then you can go home at night. Mm-hmm. So I did that for a month. And while I was there, I met a woman that just turned to me one day in group therapy, and she was like, "Do you have autism?" And I was like, "What?" You know, and I slightly felt offended, because I was still in that mentality that, like, you can see autism, you know. I'm like, what am I doing that makes me look autistic? Mm-hmm. So I was still pretty ignorant to the whole topic. And I was like, "Why do you ask?" She was like, "Well, I've been through the same thing, all of these different diagnoses." And she was like, and I went and saw a psychiatrist and did an assessment, and she was like, "Oh yeah, you're on the spectrum." And I was just like, whatever, I don't have autism. And then the pandemic hit, and I just started noticing a lot of different traits, repetitive patterns, different tendencies that I was kind of discouraged from doing when I was young, things that caused me a lot of trouble in school and even at home. And so I decided to start reading about autism, but it seemed like every time I would, it was so relative. Like, it just hit me really hard, where I'm like, this is it. And it's like I couldn't even finish an article or something, like, without crying. And so I just kept sitting it down. And I finally decided to do an assessment, and I did the ADOS, and the psychiatrist that I had just didn't seem to be, like, super educated with adults, and especially with females. So yeah. He told me that I didn't have autism, I didn't have ADHD, none of that, OCD. I was just severely depressed and anxious. And so I still ended up seeing him for a while, because he's a behavioralist, and that's, like, I've been through so much, I've had so much trauma treatment, it's like nothing was helping, and it made me feel so incompetent as a person, because I'm like, I see all these other women that have, like, experienced sexual assault or this or that or childhood trauma, and they move past it, and I'm like, why have I been in therapy for over a decade and I'm still talking about the same things and I'm not getting better? And honestly, that's where a lot of like suicidal ideations come into place, because I'm like, I'm just not a competent human being. Like, why am I chronically stressed? Like, I can't deal with even going outside sometimes. And so I stuck with him for a while, and I still, like I said, just wasn't getting better. And I had a breakdown one day in his office, and I'm just like, what is wrong with me? You know, just really losing it. And he just kind of shrugged, and I was like, oh, okay, this just isn't working. Yeah. And I came across this book called Divergent Mind, and it was written by a professor at Berkeley, and it discussed late-in-life diagnosis for her of ADHD, and then she went into the whole women being on the spectrum, being diagnosed late in life, and it just really spoke to me, and I was like, this is my life story. And so I went to my primary care, and I was like, can you find me a psychiatrist that is familiar with autism in females? And so she set me up with somebody. I did, you know, one like meeting or appointment with her, and she was like, yeah, you're on the spectrum. She's like, and I really want you to see an occupational therapist so we can kind of decipher where you stand with like social anxiety or if it's spectrum related, so on. And so I did that for a while. Lost health insurance, had to quit, recently got back into occupational therapy. But I am seeking out a more formal diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And a week ago I went and had my initial assessment with a female psychiatrist that does like the ADOS testing. And she was like, well, I definitely think you're on the spectrum. So she's like, but this is going to be like your preliminary diagnosis is autism spectrum disorder. The reason why I want to do that, though, is because I would like to get a better understanding of where my strengths and weaknesses are so I can continue to move forward in treatment and know, like, what pathways to take just outside of possibly, like, occupational therapy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at and all that. Like, so, like, I've been diagnosed, but I would like a more formal diagnosis, I
yeah.
guess.
Yeah. Let's talk about co-occurring mental health conditions, you know, as we know, study shows, you know, a lot of autistic people also have co-occurring mental health conditions or co-occurring health conditions. Mm-hmm. I myself have clinical depression, ADHD, anxiety. I don't have a thyroid anymore from Hashimoto's. What about you?
So I do have a lot of autoimmune complications, and I have since I was a child. It would develop, it was I forget the name of it, but it is like the most severe form of this autoimmune disorder where you develop ulcers in your mouth. Mm. But mine were so bad that like I couldn't eat or anything, you know, and it would come and go throughout my childhood. And then in my late teens, I started having like chronic joint pain, and they told me that I had carpal tunnel syndrome. And so I didn't do the surgery or anything like that. I would have these flares where it's like I would get really sick, or I'd have really chronic joint pain, or I'd run fever randomly, chronic fatigue. And I kept going to the doctor to try and figure it out. And I was constantly sent back to psychiatrists because they kept telling me it was psychosomatic. And so then again, that was me feeling like, well, I guess I just don't know how to treat my mental health. All of these efforts are just like, it's useless, mm-hmm. you know, like I'm just not gonna get better. And I finally got to the point where I believed it was psychosomatic, and I didn't know how to deal with it. So I had become so physically ill that I had to move home from New Mexico to Texas and live with family because I couldn't work or take care of myself. And I didn't have health insurance, so I went to a county clinic, and that doctor immediately did labs on my immune system. And he's like, I think that you have lupus. Mm. And so I'd like for you to go see a specialist. And I saw him for a while, and he diagnosed me with lupus. And if we're unfamiliar with that is, it's an autoimmune disorder where your immune system thinks that your healthy tissues are a virus. So it's constantly attacking your healthy tissues and like eating away at them and causing inflammation. And it's mm-hmm. systemic, so it affects literally every aspect of your body. And then a few years after that, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis as well. And I'm finally in remission. It took 7 years to get the diagnosis, and then probably another 7 or 8 to reach remission, which is not usual, honestly. It's a difficult condition to achieve that and also to maintain it. So I'm honestly very grateful for every day that I can get out of bed without pain. But you know, I have to do a lot of management for that disorder. I have to make sure that my mental health is in check, because if your stress levels are up, it's going to affect your immune system. And before I know it, I'm just like crashing in every aspect, physically, mentally, everything. So that has, and I've read too that like autoimmune issues are linked, can be linked to autism and can be linked to trauma.
Yeah.
So that was good to learn that, you know, and it made me feel better, you know, because I knew that like it proved that I was trying, it proved that there was something wrong.
Yeah, you know? No, for sure. Yeah, you know, and I think, and we're going to talk about masking too, but I truly, my own hypothesis is that I feel like one reason, and I haven't done a deep dive into this, but I really do feel like one reason so many autistic people also have autoimmune issues and like health issues is because masking is so hard and it's so difficult, and we do it every day, and it's like, you know, something that like autistic people just have to learn to do, and it's like constantly causing our entire nervous system to be like stressed out, mm-hmm. and like the vacillating between masking and unmasking is also like hard on our nervous system.
Yeah.
And like if your nervous system is exposed to chronic stress for X amount of time all of the time, like your body's gonna be opened up to like illness, you know, and that's my hypothesis.
No, I agree with that, because it's like the way I see it is like we become so dysregulated as autistic people trying to honestly to cater to everybody else in order to not make them uncomfortable and to fit in and play into like we've discussed workplace politics, socializing. And so when all of that becomes dysregulated, then our immune system becomes dysregulated, and it's just a trickle-down effect, you know, before you know it, you're crashed.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, so let's talk about masking. Like, for you, or for everyone, you know, research shows that masking for women will lead to negative mental health outcomes more so than men, because, you know, as women, we get, you know, we get it, you know, we get it all.
Yeah. There's different social expectations for women than there are men.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, now that you know you have autism, can you talk a little bit about ways in which, you know, masking affects you? And when you're trying to unmask, how are you doing that?
Well, I feel like I haven't quite learned, you know, the balance yet, because I feel like the sort of masking that I still do is similar to what I was doing before, where I'm just kind of training myself to behave certain ways, keep your mouth shut, don't say this or that, don't give your opinion, don't be honest in this scenario, you know, if they don't want to hear it or it's not. It blows my mind how socially unacceptable honesty is, you know, like it's so irritating. So I think a problem that I often run into, and I have in the past, is that my masking is just suppressing how I actually want to express myself, and then I kind of reach a point where I just, like, I can't take it anymore and I can't mask anymore, and then people are just like, whoa, Ashley, like, calm down type thing, you know, because, like, I think that I feel very deeply about everything, and I'm very passionate, especially, like, about my work, and when it gets to a point where, like, I feel like clients aren't being heard, or I'm not being heard when I'm advocating for them, my passion ends up coming across as aggression, and more often than not, just kind of in general, my anxiety can come across as anger. So then at that point, people don't really want to listen to me, especially because I'm a woman, you know, like the females are supposed to not get angry and not lose their temper, you know, and I'm a very temperamental person. So honestly, I still, like, I'm trying to figure out how to remedy some of that, but I realize too, like, when I'm in occupational therapy and we're discussing how to present myself in, like, social situations, public situations, work environments, it's like training yourself not to be yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I'm already doing that and I'm kind of miserable doing it, so what do?
Exactly. So what do you do? You know, we all as autistic people do have to do it. Like, so what do you do when you are trying to unmask?
Well, I think one of the ways because like masking, you know, is going to get your nervous system turned up and everything, and it's going to exhaust you. It just hits you on so many different levels. So something that I really try to practice at home is like sensory deprivation techniques. I just try to keep my home environment as comfortable as possible, and I want it to meet all of the sensory issues that I'm having. And so I notice if I maintain that regimen, it's easier for me to not like become explosive or irritable, you know, when I am masking, because like I find myself so often in conversations stopping myself, being like, okay, don't say that, like don't say this or that, you know. I'm constantly having a conversation with myself while I'm having a conversation with somebody else.
Yeah, 100%.
And then that also interferes with me being an active listener, you know what I mean, with staying present in a conversation, and also like trying to read other people's facial expressions, making sure that I'm matching them as well. Am I making too much eye contact? Am I doing this and that?
It's exhausting.
It is, yeah. So I think that like as far as masking goes, it's a lot of me having I've always got two things going on at once, basically, where I'm trying to have some self-preservation, and I'm also trying to function in this environment, in this situation that is foreign to me.
Yeah. So. No, I completely agree. I know we all do different things to like sort of like get ourselves, you know, regulated again. And, you know, especially because, you know, I mean, it really is like masking, like truly is exhausting. And I think that I think that's one reason I love having autistic friends like you and the other people that we both know and that, you know, we know and are friends with, because it's like, you know, at least when I'm around another autistic person, I'm like, all right, like, you know, like I don't think you're gonna get mad at me. I don't feel like I have to like try as hard. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just like, bah! and you're like, bah! And it's like, it's fine, you know? But like truly, like I really, you know, since I moved to Oklahoma, like that, this is like the first time I've actually had like a community of other autistic people to exist around. And like the changes I've noticed in myself just being able to exist around other autistic people, I think has been really good for my mental health personally. And so, you know, I just wanted to shout that out, because I think it is really important for people who are like-minded to find community with, you know, each other. And, you know, something else you and I also share, and I also want to say, you and I are friends because we're friends. Like, you know, we're not like trauma bonded friends. We just share similar things. But depression, you and I both struggle with depression, and we've both struggled with suicidality issues. And I know we've both gone to extreme lengths to still be here and to get a handle on our depression. So if you don't mind, can you share a little bit about like, what is that like for you, and what have you done, and what are some of the things that you do to, you know, still be here?
Okay. Well, when I was in high school, I was diagnosed with clinical depression and put on antidepressants, and I had a bad response to them every single time. By the time I got out of high school, I had tried like 3 different antidepressants. Some of them would give me like serotonin syndrome. They would make me manic. I already had issues with sleep, and they would like increase my insomnia even. And so that just wasn't the right drug, but I still took them for quite a few years, because nobody ever informed me that you need to taper off of these drugs. And so I would just stop taking them and not be okay. You know what I mean? And so I was like, wow, I really need these medications. And so I would get back on them. And then after not getting better, I started using substances. I started using when I was in high school, but it got worse, probably 1920, early 20s. And around that time, I was diagnosed with bipolar 1 disorder, which I should not have been, since I was using all sorts of drugs, you know. And I got on medication for that. That didn't really change anything other than it helped me sleep. And I was on an antipsychotic for like 13 years. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I found out I had autism that I was like, well, I'm going to get off of this medication. It's actually not doing anything for me. And I feel so much better not being on it. But I mean, I've been through like every single class of psychiatric medications, and none of them have worked, you know. And it got to a point where they're like, you have treatment resistant depression and we don't know what else to do for you. You know, like I've lost so many jobs, so many relationships. Like I just, my depression always gets me back to a point like of isolation. And I'm always like in a state of despair at that point. And then I start to develop things like agoraphobia and all sorts of insecurities. Like, I've experienced like psychotic depression where you start getting like kind of delusional. You know, it's not like the same sort of delusions that you might have if you're schizophrenic where you think the government's breaking into your home at night and stealing your organs. It's more like, I think somebody broke into my home and moved around my things. You know what I mean? Like, it could happen, but it's probably not going to happen, you know? So it's like, because of I wasn't getting the right treatment, my depression just wasn't going away and it was getting worse and worse. And every time I would have these burnouts, it's like I would lose part of myself that I wouldn't get back. And so my depression, it's like it became chronic, you know, and it's just, it got so much harder to deal with. And they told me, they're like, well, I went to inpatient treatment, it was in 2021. And they're like, your only options at this point, honestly, are shock therapy or ketamine treatment. And I just didn't want to do shock therapy. And I didn't have the money for ketamine at the time, but later, maybe 8 months later, I managed to get the money together for it. And I went through ketamine treatment. It was really intense and really grueling at first. But I definitely credit that to saving my life, you know? So I've had to go to extremes, I feel like, to treat my depression. And if I hadn't, like, my plan with the ketamine treatment was, if it doesn't work, then I'll kill myself.
Yeah.
Because that's like the end of the line. And because I really was refusing to do shock therapy. But I'm truly grateful that ketamine worked for me.
Yeah, you know, I know we're talking about these things like we haven't talked about mm-hmm. them before, so it's like kind of weird. But I do really understand what you mean about like how like with ketamine, it was like, I'm trying this, and if this doesn't work, then I'm killing myself. Because for me in 2020, you know, I had gotten West Nile in 2018, and that was, you know, made me really sick for a really long time. And then I had an advanced form of Hashimoto's, and then all of a sudden I'm getting a total thyroidectomy on my 31st birthday. And, you know, no one told me that when they remove a pretty crucial body part, your body kind of like goes through its own like manicness when it realizes the body part's no longer there. So I had surgery and I actually felt like super, like the happiest I'd ever felt before for like a month or so after the surgery. And then my mom was the one who was like, I think you're experiencing like, you know, post-surgical, like a high, like, you know, it might not feel this way. And it hit me like a ton of bricks when it went away. And I became, honestly, one of the most depressed I'd ever been. And I actually, you know, had like an episode where I just ate all my pills one night and just was like, you know what, screw it, whatever. And then I like called my friend who I forgot lived in Seattle and left her a voicemail. And so she called my mom. And the next thing I know, I'm at the ER telling them what I did. And after that, I was just like, I've done everything and nothing has worked. And yet I still have like this incessant voice in my head that's like, you don't really want to be here because life really truly isn't worth living. Like there's no point. And then I started getting TMS ads to me on social media, which is transcranial electromagnetic stimulation. It's not electroshock therapy, but anyways, I went through the whole process of getting approved for that and then did TMS for 2 months straight. And I was in the same position where you are, where I was like, I'm trying this because it's TMS is also a last resort. Yeah. Like you cannot get it if you have not exhausted all other options. And I, you know, so I really do feel you on that because for me, that helped me a lot. And I was like, okay, well, you know, finally, you know, something worked. And, you know, I think more people probably have been in positions like us and it's just not talked about enough, you know. And I, my personal opinion is, even though I got TMS and even though I think it worked for me, I still do feel depressed at times. And I do still also find myself like actively pushing away thoughts of like, well, life really is just pointless, you know, just kill yourself, just kill yourself, just kill yourself.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the TMS gave, did something for me, because I can more easily just be like, I know that this is just a swell in the ocean of my mind and it's gonna recede and it's gonna be fine. Like, does anything like that happen for you still, like, even though you've done ketamine and you think it helped you? Or
I feel like I don't battle so much with like suicidal ideation, but that can kind of go back to experiences I had on ketamine, where I kind of came out of it and I feel silly saying I had like a spiritual awakening, but I had this one infusion, and I guess I just won't go into detail about it, but I came out of it just not being afraid to die anymore. And I still feel that way. And I do think life is pointless. Like, I don't think that there is a purpose to all of this. So we have to create our own purpose, because it's only going to be one time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the first time I had considered suicide, I think I'd started thinking about it around the time I was 14. And then when I was 16, I'd actually become addicted to sleeping pills at that point, and I was taking them to sleep, but also during the day for anxiety. And I took some one night to try and overdose, and then I panicked and made myself throw up. And then when I was 19, I attempted to overdose on lorazepam, because I had a prescription of that, but, you know, I wasn't doing research on how to kill myself, so I didn't do it well, which is fine. But after that, I felt like I couldn't do it to my family, especially my father, because I just think that if I did that, I would be killing both of us, because I didn't think that he would be able to cope with it. And that's, you know, around the time that I was on ketamine. My dad had died months before that, and so I was like, okay, well, because I was waiting till he died to kill myself, but then I managed to have the money to pay for ketamine, and that's when I was like, okay, if ketamine doesn't work, then I'll do it. But a few years prior to that, actually, before I moved to Oklahoma, I was just so fed up with having lupus and the treatment and feeling every day like I'm physically dying, that I got to the point where I was like, I was heavily, thoroughly researching ways to kill myself where it wouldn't be like a mess for somebody to find, or a mess for my family to find, or for them to have to identify the body or whatever. And so my other route was going to be to just stop treatment and let the disease kill me, you know? But I have a friend that lives up here, and she's like, you know, there's a research facility that does a lot of treatment for lupus, and they do research studies, this and that. And so that's why I moved here, gotten a research study. The medication that I was able to add to my current regimen helped me go into remission, along with like dietary lifestyle changes, you know? So there's been a few different ways where I've considered killing myself or tried, you know? And plenty of times where like I've come up with reasons to back out of it. But, you know, it's a looming thought, you know? I mean.
Yeah, you know, I do like what you said though about how you realize you sort of have to make your own purpose in life. And can you just elaborate on, for you, what does that mean for you?
I think I'm so grateful that finding a treatment for my depression, understanding that I have autism, and also going into remission with my autoimmune diseases, I just realized like how lucky I was, and also how lucky I was that I had somebody to support me through those times. And I'm well aware that not everybody has that. And so I felt like, since I'm capable of helping other people, that's what I want to do. And because of the whole, like, I feel like there's, me saying that I feel like there's no purpose, is that I also feel like there's no like reward system in life. Like, when people are going through traumatic experiences, I don't necessarily think that they're being punished so they can be rewarded after they die. And so I feel like a purpose of mine is, or what I want to do to create a purpose is to help reduce suffering as much as I can while I'm on this earth. And so that's why I've chosen the path of going into social work, because I know that I could have very easily been there. There are people there that don't have the same mental health complications and physical health complications, or haven't been through the same sorts of trauma that I have been, yet they're there and I'm not. Mm-hmm. And so I've found a great deal of purpose in that. And also, I think that I find purpose in my comedy as well, because I've had people come up to me after shows or after sets, and they're just like, that's so relatable. Like, it's dark, but like, I get it. And like, they appreciate that I can get on stage and say that, you know, and laugh about it. Because a lot of times, for the longest time, I didn't feel like it was okay to laugh about these things. And like, now I feel like it's like the only way to do it.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I know it's one way, it's actually how we met. But I know it's another way we both, you know, practice wellness. So, as an artist, because comedy is art, as an artist, as a comic, what does doing comedy do for you personally? And like, with like the things that you talk about and just your overall, how does it give you wellness?
I think so. Something that's interesting. Well, I don't know if it's interesting, but, in real life, I don't enjoy making people uncomfortable, but I do it all the time and unintentionally. But I love making people uncomfortable when I'm on stage. Like, I'm like, y'all have, because I look at it, I'm like, all of you have been making me feel uncomfortable for a very long time. So I'm just going to lay it all out there and make all of you extremely uncomfortable. Yeah. And some of you are going to get it, and you're going to laugh at it, and you'll love it. You know, so it's just, there is such a liberating aspect of it that I enjoy. I can have a completely terrible set, or what might be deemed as a terrible set, because like nobody laughed or anything, but I know that I performed it exactly the way I wanted to, and I was really feeling like the emotions of it. Where, you know, sometimes you have those sets where it's just like every single movement feels deliberate, but it feels natural too, you know? And it's when I walk off stage on those sets that I feel really good. But I am going to ask a question. Like, there have been sets before where, like, this happened at the show that you put on, it was Cody, John, and
The one at Workflow.
Yeah. Like, then there was a set at JJ's like a week before that where the place was packed and I had everybody's attention. Like, and that it's hard to do that there, and I've only done it that one time. But I walk off stage and it's like I just scored a touchdown and I want to like hit my chest. You know, it's just like, it feels so good. It's like it gets me high. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's been a good replacement for drugs and alcohol since I stopped doing that. I don't know. It just like, it fulfills me on so many different levels, because I've been writing for 24 years now. Like, I started writing when I was young. And then during the pandemic, right before the pandemic started, I was like, I'm gonna start comedy because I just don't know what to do with all this trauma. And it's time to laugh about it. And of course, the pandemic happened. I couldn't do stand-up. Nobody was doing anything. And so I just did tons of writing. And it took me a long time to finally get on stage. But once I did, like the first time I was on stage, it was just like an out-of-body experience, you know? And I got up there and I said some of the most brutal, dark things about myself. And it honestly like killed the first time, like it. And so I was like, I'm gonna do this from now on. So, I mean, I don't know like necessarily what direction I want it to take me in, or how, I don't know that I wanna be like a big star or anything, but yeah. I just like, it is such a good therapy and it makes me feel good about myself, you know?
Yeah, no, so for you, because for me, I also feel like, you know, our comedic styles are very similar in the sense of, we both talk about, you know, for people who don't know, you know, we both talk about autism and, you know, mental health, and we both lean towards the darker side and trying to make tough things comical. For me, it sort of helped me like wash away shame. Mm-hmm. I had. Do you feel
yes,
the same
for
way?
Sure. Yeah, for sure. Because that's like, have you ever, have you gone through phases in life where it's just like you walk around and just feel embarrassed about
to
everything?
Exist. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember talking to a doctor about that. It was actually a somatic therapist, because I've seen every type of therapist there is. And she was like, Ashley, that's shame. And I was like, well, I thought, I didn't realize that embarrassment and shame were essentially the same thing. And so it's really hard for me to feel embarrassed when I'm on stage. Honestly, like maybe I'm not satisfied with my set, but I don't walk off stage like calling myself a stupid idiot, you know? I'm proud of myself that I did it regardless of the outcome, you know? So it's just like, it like boosts my self-esteem in a way that I didn't think was attainable, you
yeah.
know?
So. No, I agree. And are there any other ways that you like to show yourself, you know, wellness? And, you know, what are just, what? How does Ashley give herself wellness?
You know, after we did that, you did the autism social where we messed around with polymer clay.
Yeah.
So I just started playing with polymer clay a few days ago and bought some, and I can't stop doing it. So like right now I'm just really focused in on that, watching lots of tutorials and playing around with it. And so like when I'm at work now, I'm like, I want to go home and play with polymer clay.
Yeah.
You know, because for the longest time, like I painted like compulsively, and I lost a lot of things that I did for wellness when I became sick, because I went through a period of time where like I wasn't getting out of bed, you know. My hands were too stiff and in pain to even write or paint, you know, and this went on for years. And so since I've gone into remission, since I've figured out that I have autism and more things about my mental health, finding different outlets. Yeah, after having like lost a lot of the things that like brought me therapy due to my illness, so it just took time for me to find different routes and different, like I need to make things that are creative, you know. I need to make things with my hands. I need to be able to pull these like thoughts and like scattered emotions and somehow put it on paper or on a canvas or in words that I can perform on stage. And I try to, something I want to try and start doing is going away on like little weekend trips alone, maybe to just like small towns and finding a place that has a lake or, you know, nature paths, or go rent a cabin or something somewhere. So I'm trying to think about things that, because I do need to isolate more often, I think, maybe than average people, but I want to make sure I'm not isolating in my apartment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I'm trying to really, I'm trying to pay close attention to what I'm doing for myself, you know, because like I said, I know I need isolation, but like staying at home alone in my apartment is not good isolation.
Yeah.
So, but that's definitely, I mean, getting my alone time is definitely part of my wellness plan.
Yeah, no, alone time is a wellness thing for me as well. Mm-hmm. I need to be alone to feel, you know, my best self, for real, you know. But no, I think that that's great, you know, and I really appreciate you coming back on the podcast to talk to me more. And before we go, I'd like to ask all autistic people about this, what your favorite stereotype about autism is and what your least favorite stereotype about autism is.
I think my least favorite stereotype might be that we're all extremely smart. Like, because sometimes when people are like, oh, what kind of autism? I'm like, not the smart kind. Sorry. Like, I'm more, and that's something I've learned too. Like, with females, it's more in line with, like, the music and arts. It's not, like, academic the way, like, males are, they excel in things like that. So I don't like that, I guess. Favorite stereotype. I don't really know. I know last time I said that I like that we're all considered like weird and odd, but yeah.
Hey, you can like that.
That's it. Yeah.
Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
No, but anyways, I love you. Thank you
I
so much
you
for sharing your story more in depth. And that is all I have for you all today. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you again for tuning in to Unmasking Autism with AFO. I'm your host, Carly Marissa Dummett. Thank you again to the Oklahoma State Department of Health. And for any information on our trainings or our events, please visit www.autismfoundationok.org or follow us on social media platforms at Autism Foundation OK. As always, thank you so much, and we'll see you next time.